If I was going to add a little drama to this, I would say that Ember declared war on native apps.
I think that's kind of fair. Yeah, sure. Why not?
A lot of the keynote was about how other frameworks have taken this approach of bringing web technologies and dropping them into native experiences. React Native being the prime example. And Ember, I got the feeling today that Ember really wants to make web technologies bring back the old glory.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have anything personal against native apps. I use a lot of them, and I think that there are a lot of situations where native apps provide a better experience. And I actually don't care at all about what technology you use. I care about the user experience. And I think that what's happened is there's kind of like this false accounting that people do. There's this problem where it's like, you know, in the 50s and 60s, it said no one ever gets fired for buying IBM. And that's where we're today. No one ever gets fired for building a native app.
Right.
And that means that people just take the thinking out of the equation and they just say, well, what is everyone else doing? And everyone else has a native app. Everyone else puts up an interstitial that tries to bounce you to the app store. And they don't really focus on the user experience. So the thing we tried to show in the keynote is apps are great once they're on the phone.
Right.
But if you're tapping a link on Twitter or on a Google search and it takes you to the app store and you have to wait a minute or more, because native applications are like 80 megabytes. Facebook's 80 megabytes to download.
Right.
And everyone's complaining about JavaScript apps being like 500, 600K, a megabyte of JavaScript. Oh, it's so big.
Well, that's only one of the like three Facebook apps
you need.
Oh, sorry. If you do Messenger.
It's like 120 megs.
Yeah.
Do you think there's experiences that make more sense in native than they do in web tech?
I think there's always going to be APIs that roll out to native first. And if you're writing a game, I think that's fine. If you need access to the hardware, I think that writing a native app makes a lot of sense. But I don't think there's any reason that like Pinterest needs to be a native app. I don't think there's a reason Facebook needs to be a native app. It's not taking advantage of anything that you can't do on the web.
So what are the fundamentals? Like, what do we need to do in Ember to create a great mobile experience?
So this is the tricky thing, right? Because you're kind of fighting a two-front war as a mobile developer. You have all the native people who say, well, you need to author an experience for the web that is competitive with us as native developers. And then you have old school web people who say, well, you need to load as fast as us if you want to have a good web experience.
Right.
So you're kind of caught in the crossfire. No matter what you do, someone's going to criticize you. You either have too much JavaScript or you don't have enough features. And so the question is, how do you kind of bend this curve? There's this trade-off that you have to make. How do you bend that curve? And for us, that means thinking smart about breaking your application up into pieces and streaming it effectively. Mm-hmm. And actually, Ember's pretty well set up to do that because we have a very conventional app structure that is focused on the routes in your app. We already break your app up into pages, and so it's pretty easy for us to figure out, okay, well, how do we break that up into pieces and only give the user what they need to see that one particular page? Things like Fastboot mean that we can keep your app resident in memory on Heroku or whatever host you're using.
And you can
serve it up very fast, right? And that's a way of outsourcing the JavaScript runtime to Heroku until the JavaScript finishes loading on the client. And I think that, and the last thing is just taking advantage of features that maybe we have forgotten about or that have gotten a bad reputation.
App cache is the
best example.
Yeah.
People think of app cache as a deprecated technology, and I'm not surprised they think that, because you go on the MDN website and there's big scary warnings. Yeah. This is deprecated and will be removed.
Well, both Chrome and Firefox have officially said they're deprecating. Right?
They've officially said they've deprecated, but if you look at it, it has incredible feature penetration. It's in far more browsers than Service Worker or ES6 or any of these things.
Yep.
And so Service Worker is obviously the future, but it's not well distributed yet. And app cache is in something like 90% of browsers globally. And in my opinion, app cache is a little bit hard to work with. There are rough edges. It's not a perfect API. There's no question about that. But it exists. It's in the browser. And I think there was this era, this feeling of scrappiness in the jQuery era, in the IE6 era. So you know what? I mean, you had to know all these hacks just to put a div in the right place on the screen. And people spent hours and hours and days figuring out hacks to make it happen. And I think we need that spirit of scrappiness again and saying, yeah, this API sucks, but let's build tools to make it pleasant, just like jQuery did.
Right.
There's really no excuse that if your app boots in more than 200 milliseconds, if on second boot, right? You can put all of those assets in the browser's cache, and there's no reason you should download those if the user's been to your page before.
Yeah, we've just really never done caching very well. Like, the whole JavaScript community has always been a little bit allergic to caching for some reason.
Well, it's one of the hard computer science problems.
It is. What well, is it? Caching and concurrency?
No. And plus
naming
one.
Things.
Naming things. Naming things. That's
and
it.
Then regular expressions, then yeah. You have two problems. Yeah. So there are three. Yeah. But, I mean, here's the bottom line. HTTP caching, which is what most people think about when they think about caching for their JavaScript applications, is from an era where most things were rendered on the server. And it's just HTTP caching is just not appropriate when you're adopting a client-side architecture. And that's why AppCache exists. And again, yeah, it has rough edges. But I think what we can do in the Ember community is write a bunch of tools so that you as a developer don't have to learn all those edge cases. We will just say, write your application the Ember way, and we will give you all the advantages of AppCache out of the box.
So you mentioned Fastboot.
Yep.
Terrence has been working really hard to make the Fastboot experience with the new open source Heroku build pack amazing. You
yep.
use that to deploy ember-fastboot.com.
So the Ember Fastboot website is itself an Ember Fastboot app. It's an Ember app running on Fastboot on Heroku. That's been really awesome. We've collaborated really closely with Terrence. He was up late the night before the keynote helping me make sure it was out and fast. And actually, I have to say I'm incredibly impressed. It was on the front page of Hacker News for the entire day, which usually amounts to at least 100-some thousand hits, and it was just so fast the entire time.
Awesome.
We've actually gotten tweets about how fast it is.
Yes, it's fast. Because it's pretty mind-bending. You're used to having this trade-off on the web. Either a page is really fast, but because it's rendered on the server to load, but then each navigation you have to keep talking to the server, but the Fastboot website is different. You hit it, you get HTML, but then the JavaScript loads in the background. So each click after that is not having to talk to the server. It's all rendered on your local, on your browser, local machine.
So yeah, it's really important to be fast, especially when you put like fast in the name of the product.
Right, yes, it would be embarrassing if...
With slow boot?
Right, yeah, yeah. Actually, so Dockyard, which is a consultancy that does a lot of Ember projects, they just recently moved their homepage to Fastboot. And so I asked them if they could do a non-Fastboot version of it that I could just compare against and see what they... That's slowboot.dockyard.com.
Oh, sweet. And how slow is it? Does it feel slow?
On a modern device, on broadband, really imperceptible for the most part. Mm-hmm. But where you really notice it is if you're on a slower connection, like a 2G or a 3G connection. That's where things like Fastboot really matter. And of course, not all devices have JavaScript. Not all crawlers have JavaScript. And you might be on a mobile device, and maybe your connection drops and that JavaScript doesn't load. It's still nice to be able to see the content.
Absolutely. Do you think, is there other things about a Fastboot application that developers should consider when adopting? Is there other reasons to adopt Fastboot? SEO, for example?
So SEO is a big one. I think one that maybe not a lot of people think about is Facebook Open Graph tags and Twitter cards.
Oh yeah,
because you can add these annotations to your HTML, and Facebook and Twitter use these to create a much nicer experience when someone pastes your URL into like a share box or whatever.
Right.
And that requires server rendering and adding these, and so that's been one really key thing that we've
very
done.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've actually experienced that myself. That is pretty gross. I got a couple apps with some pretty gross.
Yeah, you paste in a link to a JavaScript app, and it's just this totally garbage preview.
Yeah,
who needs that?
So in terms of adopting Fastboot and the migration story, like I think the consensus today is that like Fastboot is new. You should start experimenting with it. When is it going to be something that people can use in production applications?
Well, I mean, I'm personally rolling out to production very soon and have in several client projects I'm working on. But it is pre 1.0 software. We're going to release 1.0 along with Ember 2.7. And so I think we're on 2.5 now, and we do 6-week release cycles. So in probably about 12 weeks, more or less. And the thing about...
I was not expecting such a concrete date. That's
yeah, so, I mean, the thing is we've been working on it for the last year, and it ended up being a much harder problem than I thought, but I think we're very close. We've cracked a lot of really important nuts. The most important thing to think about when you're trying to migrate to Fastboot and adopt it is you really have to realize, okay, you're now writing an application that's no longer running in just the browser. You're writing an application that has to run in Node as well, and so you have to use the unified subset between those two. There's the Node environment and the browser environment, and they don't have the same things.
The DOM, for example.
The DOM is a big one, right? So, but and actually, it ends up being okay. That sounds like it may be kind of a fatal restriction, but in practice, Ember apps are very well structured, and most things are within specific lifecycle hooks. Like on a component, for example, if you write a component, a lot of the behavior you have that relies on the DOM existing is inside this hook called didn't serve element. And so what we do in Fastboot, we just don't call it. Right. We just render your app, we render your templates, and if there's anything that you wanted to do that would touch the DOM, we just don't do it.
So it kind of forces you into some best practices, too.
I would say that, yeah. It definitely requires you to clean up your app, and because Fastboot apps run concurrently, you have to make sure that you don't have any shared global state.
Right.
And so that might be a problem if you have a messy app, but in general, I think it helps you justify putting in a little bit of effort to clean it up.
We've almost convinced the rest of the world that that's important on the server, too. We're getting there very slowly at Heroku.
Do you think this duality is going to hurt the adoption? Like, people might get scared away because in a lot of times when you're shipping stuff to production, you take a lot of shortcuts, right?
Sure.
And so you're, more often than not, I'm sure all these things you said are in many production Ember apps today in production.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I've migrated a few really large apps, and in practice, it's maybe a couple weeks of work for big apps that have been around for a few years. There's no question about that. I think the benefits are worth it. But the other thing I'll say about that is I think, you know, Node when it started was just some people taking V8 and binding it to their own environment that they created to bind into into Unix system calls, right? It's basically what Node is, V8 plus Unix. But what you're seeing happening is that people are starting to take Node on the server a lot more seriously, and more importantly, the process of developing JavaScript as a language is becoming more open, and there's far more contributors to it now. It used to be all just mostly browser vendors, but now you have practitioners, you have people from Node who are on TC39. And I think what you're going to start seeing, because there's so much interest in this idea of running the same code on the client, on the browser and on the server, I actually think what you're going to end up seeing is that those environments are going to become a lot more unified than before. And so a lot of the gotchas that might exist today, I think as Node evolves and as JavaScript evolves and the browser evolves, I think the differences between those environments are slowly going to converge.
Do you see, what are the major differences, I guess, between the approach that the Ember community has taken in, for example, like universal apps in React?
When you say universal apps, do you mean like with React Native or with server-side rendering?
I'm sort of pointing at a bit of vaporware there, but yeah, like the server-side rendering that you're seeing in a lot of the boilerplates.
Yeah, so and I know that a lot of people in the React community have taken issue with me. I said in one Hacker News comment that React server-side rendering is just flat out not the same as Fastboot. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people took issue with that. And I'm not saying that people cannot render React apps on the server. It's obviously possible. Mm-hmm. But there is a huge gulf between taking a component and being able to render it synchronously and what Fastboot does. Because Fastboot, the act of rendering a component on the server is a very small percentage of what we spent the last year and a half doing. The biggest thing was figuring out people are writing these browser applications assuming that the app boots and it runs inside this browser window and then the user closes the tab and that's it.
Right.
But when you're serving an application concurrently, you need to figure out how do you run multiple instances of this app cheaply. And so the biggest thing that we focused on is application architecture. How do we create an application architecture where we can boot your app in Node and easily and cheaply create instances of it to serve each request and then very quickly and easily tear them down? We need to keep all the state in one conventional place. Mm-hmm. And React is the V in MVC. React doesn't tell you anything about how to architect your application. There's like Flux, Fluxor, Reflux, Relay, Redux, all of these things. And if you want to do server-side rendering, you need to figure out how to take the combination that you've chosen, which is like, you know, Redux plus React plus whatever React router, whatever combination you're using, and you have to figure out how to boot that node. You need to figure out how to serve it concurrently. You need to figure out how to deal with loading async data and then rendering it out. And I'm not saying it's impossible to do it. Obviously, it's possible to do it because we did in Fastboot, and JavaScript is a Turing-complete language. So yes, you can absolutely do the same thing as we did because we're operating the same programming language. But the biggest thing about Fastboot is that it installs in just one command. You say ember install ember CLI Fastboot, and you now have server-side rendering in your app. And there's a big difference between one command and running that infrastructure yourself.
So I think that's one philosophy that Heroku and the Ember community really share is that developer experience matters. Like how you feel while you build your application matters.
Well, that's something we got from Rails, right?
Yeah,
there's a big difference between is something possible and is something easy. And if you're going down the feature checklist, it may seem like they're equivalent, but ease of use is a feature.
changing gears for a sec, because you brought up JavaScript on server and I can't resist. Do you think Swift will ever come to the server? Like, it seems like that's a thing that's...
They open sourced it, so I have to assume that there will be...
There's web frameworks popping up.
Yeah.
I said a few years ago that JavaScript would never happen on the server, and I was proven wrong, like, almost immediately. So yeah.
I think Swift is a great language. I think it's definitely likely to have a thriving ecosystem of server apps, just because you have this whole community of people writing iOS apps who are learning Swift, and they love Swift.
They do love Swift. They're very passionate about the language, for sure.
I personally am a little bit more excited about Rust than Swift, but...
We're excited about Rust, too.
But I think they're both great languages.
So, we're talking about Rust. Why don't we talk a little bit about Rust? So, there's a lot of Rust happening in the Ember community, right? That's like a... This is a thing?
I don't know if there's a lot of...
There's what... Helix, the JavaScript Rust bridge stuff.
Isn't that called Neon?
Oh, yeah, Neon.
Yeah.
Neon Helix is, I guess, the Ruby one. My bad.
Okay. Sorry.
Get
like,
out of the Ruby
community. I was like, oh, my God, I'm the worst thought leader ever. I have no idea what you're talking about. I need to retire. That's from Dave.
Yeah.
At Mozilla. So Neon is a really exciting way to say JavaScript is a very widely known language. People feel very productive in it. People love Node. But it doesn't always provide the best performance, because it was not designed to. It was designed to run in a browser and be garbage collected and so on. And so Neon is a way to say, this little piece of my Node application is running slowly. Let me rewrite just this little piece in Rust and have this bridge into it.
Cool.
Which is really exciting.
Yeah.
I think that is probably the epic win for Rust.
Yeah, for sure.
Because you don't necessarily want to be writing Rust all the time, because it does require you to think about memory management and data flow and ownership and all these things, which are important things to think about. But if I didn't have to, I wouldn't want to think about it.
There's also string manipulation in Rust. You realize it is also a systems level program.
Yes.
It's a systems level program. It's a systems level language. You don't hate writing. I mean, that's...
Well, it depends on how much you fight the borrow checker, I guess.
So Dave Herman, who wrote Neon and manages Rust at Mozilla, the way that he put it to me, which I thought helped clarify my thinking, is that JavaScript is a fantastic language, but performance is not in what he calls the domain of discourse. You can't talk about low-level things in JavaScript the way that you can with Rust. And so the benefit of Rust is... of Neon is you can write all your stuff in JavaScript, you profile it, you figure out, oh, this 1% of my code is slow, let me rewrite that in Rust.
Wow. Okay, so, sorry, aside. Back on track. Ember Things. I was personally blown away by how many people are actually just at this conference in general. Like, the Ember community feels like it's really exploded.
Yes.
This conference, it feels a little bit like... I mean, it definitely feels inspired by the Ruby community. There's lots of hugging and stuff going on. but it feels like that's kind of the purpose of this conference a little bit, was to kind of bring this community even closer, because it's growing so fast.
Right.
Was that something you did consciously, or did it just happen?
I think it's kind of a blend of both. But, you know, Yehuda and Leah both came from the Ruby and Rails community, and... You know, when in doubt, just steal what works is kind of our philosophy of everything, I guess. And I think that community in particular is really, I think, great for their focus on developer ergonomics, community, and there's kind of this authenticity to it, this open source, where it feels very scrappy. And there's no one company that has this locus of control. It's kind of this chaotic free-for-all, which I really love. And it is astounding. It's like 950 people here, right? So almost 1,000 people. Last year was 600 people. Before that, 300. And then Ember Camp, the first year, was like 150 people. So it's like it's nearly doubling every year, 300 new people every year. So I don't know where we're going to find a venue for next year when it's like, you know, 3,000 people. But it's interesting because... You know, on the server, you have control over what programming language you have. And so I think, you know, people have different beliefs about how to build software. And on the server, I think people tend to they kind of decamp into different programming language communities. So if you value convention over configuration and, you know, Matz's philosophy about the computer should be serving the human, not vice versa, then you would kind of decamp into the Ruby community. Or if you're more of like a corporate person and you value stability, maybe you go to like .NET or Java. But the interesting thing about JavaScript is that I think it's like the world's biggest pool of of community. And so this kind of natural segregation that might have happened otherwise, now people with radically different philosophies are kind of swimming in the same pool. And so you look at EmberConf, and there's like 1,000 people here, and Ember powers some huge websites like the Heroku dashboard. It powers Twitch, Square, Apple Music is an Ember app, right? So you have these massive companies building these huge products in this thing, and yet there's this perception that Ember is kind of like a, I guess, like a minority framework compared to like React or Angular. And to me, I think part of that is just that this community is really huge. And I think people want to, people like a narrative of winner takes all, but it's just too big of a community for that to ever happen. I'm really excited about all the work that React and Angular 2 are doing, and I think we all have a good working relationship, and we just very liberally steal ideas from each other.
Do you think some of that perception comes from the fact that they have like large corporate sponsors, and Ember doesn't in the same sense? It isn't.
Yeah, maybe. I think that there are a lot of people who especially initially adopted Angular because they felt that Google is a name they've heard of. It's a brand name. They can go to their executives or their managers and be like, here's this framework from Google. And they're like, I have heard of that company.
It's the IBM thing, right?
Yeah, back to the IBM thing. But I think now, I actually think Ember probably has the best reputation for stability just because the project's been around since 2011. And I don't think that you could have made a better bet on front-end technology in 2011 than Ember. Because think about the average app from 2011. It's like Grunt and Backbone and whoever knows what else. All a bunch of handheld code. Yeah. And so all of those apps are like, oh, God, I need to rewrite it in Angular. And then like Angular 1 app, and it's like, oh, God, now I need to rewrite it in React. But what you see here, you can go out at EmberConf and talk to people, and they'll be like, yeah, I've been using Ember on the same app for like 4 years. And that's awesome.
How much of that do you credit to the release cycle that you introduced pretty early on, like the three-phase release cycle, which now is five?
Yeah, so the release cycle, I think, is huge. It gives people a lot of visibility into the process. It means that there's this very reliable cadence. We're shipping features, a small set of features consistently, but we had to do a lot of innovation. To tell you the truth, it was we had to figure out, how do you do a six-week release cycle a la browsers with breaking changes? Because browsers on the web, you can't remove features, and it's additive only. So they just keep adding features every 6 weeks, and what are you on now? Like Chrome 49 is out now, right? So it's just like new features. But for us, we said, okay, well, now we want to do a 2.0. So how do we do this process? And so it definitely took some fine-tuning, and we made a lot of mistakes, but I'm really excited about Ember 3. And the thing we figured out is, okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to deprecate features in the release. We'll say, this is a thing that we don't think you should use anymore. Please use this other thing. And then you will have plenty of time to fix those deprecations. And then when the breaking change comes, there's no new features, which I think is maybe a first in the history of software. We released Ember 2.0 with no new features. I don't think it's ever happened before. Yeah. All we did was remove the deprecated ones. And this is really nice because it means that people aren't waiting around for the next big release so they can use that new feature. They can stay on that branch that they're on right now, and they know that all the goodies that are coming, they're going to get without having to upgrade, which I think is cool.
How much of that was inspired by like the looking at the community and the way that we in some cases mishandled new releases? As an example, Angular 1 to 2, like there was some friction there. Like, did you learn a lot from looking out and saying, this is what other people are doing and it isn't working?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the most important things in open source is having people's trust. Without trust, it's very hard to build a community. And I think a big part of the way that we build that trust is by making all of our decisions in the open. So we didn't announce Ember 2.0 and say, this is what we're doing, here's the plan. What we did is we went through our own RFC process and we said, this is what we would like to do with Ember 2.0. Here is our plan, these are the features we want to get in, this is how we want to do it. And we opened that up to the community, and that feedback was invaluable. And I think most importantly, people didn't feel like they were being dictated to by the small core team. They felt, I hope the way that people felt is that we were soliciting their feedback and we wanted to hear and make sure, okay, you know, we have a core team of like 12 or 13 people, and they're all on, you know, different companies from some like megacorps all the way down to like individual single consultants. So we like to have a diversity of views within the core team, but this really just helps us make sure that we get that long tail of people using the software and making sure that we're taking their needs into account.
And three new mini teams now? Three new mini core teams?
Three new mini core teams, sub teams. So that actually came from Rust. So Yehuda is on the is on the Ember core team and the Rust core team. And so there's a lot of cross-pollination in terms of governance. I think both teams end up having one problem before the other one, and we come up with unique solutions. And so we kind of share ideas for how to openly govern an open source project. And I think that is a good way of balancing the unity of vision. I think focus and vision are incredibly important for an open source project. But at the same time, when you have something at the scale of Ember, you really don't want to create a bottleneck of decision making. And so this is a nice balance between delegating that authority for people to have that autonomy and make decisions, and at the same time keep a like laser focus of the framework.
Last question. What should we do with Fastboot next? Like, how can Heroku help make Fastboot better?
I think the most important thing that we can do is, honestly, probably just getting the word out. Because I think a lot of people have this idea of JavaScript as being, JavaScript apps, of being slow, inaccessible, they break a lot, they're inaccessible to search crawlers, people who have JavaScript turned off. And I think with Fastboot, Fastboot is a pretty groundbreaking technology, I think. I think it really fundamentally changes the calculus that you have to do when deciding whether to do server rendered or client side rendered. And I think getting people to take another look at JavaScript apps, given that the context around them has changed, I think that's going to be the most important thing. And I think people will be pleasantly surprised at the things that they thought JavaScript apps couldn't do that they can do now.
Challenge accepted.